Stuart, thank you so much for doing the podcast with us. And I wonder if you could just start off by telling us what the book Badges Without Borders is all about.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me to speak with you, Robbie. Badges Without Borders is a book about the intersection of foreign and domestic policy in the United States, specifically as it pertains to policing. And I argue in the book that policing, in fact, is in contrast to the way we might typically think of it as a very localized and domestic enterprise, it's actually really well suited to a type of analysis that exceeds borders, national borders, and categorical borders of state power. And I engage in this analysis by looking at the period of the Cold War, approximately 1945 to 1975, when the United States sent police experts, police trainers around the globe to improve and upgrade the policing capabilities of dozens of countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And because this was the Cold War, this was a moment when the United States was deeply fearful of the outbreak of socialist or communist revolution in the so-called Third World. And the national security apparatus of the United States decided that policing would be, as they called it, the first line of defense against communist subversion. So they enrolled the kind of top leading policing experts, the types of people who wrote the policing textbooks, who taught classes at universities about policing, who were police chiefs in a number of towns and cities across the country, wrote in the professional literature. They sent these folks around the globe. And so a major part of the book is looking at what they did overseas, but then another part of the book is then looking at how they then influenced the apparatus of policing within the United States. And of course, particularly in the 1960s, amid the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, and urban unrest, the expertise of police who were charged with, you know, controlling unrest or political subversion overseas came to be really crucial within the United States. And I show how the declaration of a war on crime in the 1960s actually drew upon the experience and expertise of these figures who were really globetrotting in their careers.
And of course, there's a whole load of contemporary significance for that book now, right? But we'll get onto that in a minute. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, in international relations especially, when people think about violence and, you know, apparatus of violence, there's usually a distinction people make between the police, which is seen as the domestic, you know, the kind of slightly softer kind of force, but certainly domestic, right? And then the military. And the military, you know, there's nothing about justice in the military. The military is about war, etc. So, you know, for much of the history of the field, it would make absolutely no sense to say I talk about police in either foreign policy or in international relations, yeah? And I wonder how you would respond to that kind of division, police, domestic, military, foreign.
Yeah, I think that the book in many ways is trying to push back against that assumption and trying to show empirically why there might be good reason to rethink it. In part because the post-1945 international system, of course, with the term Cold War, you know, implying the kind of absence of a shooting war. We know that there certainly was a lot of shooting war in that period. There was a lot of violence between states and internal to states. But with the United States leading the international system in competition with the Soviets, in competition with China for spheres of influence around the globe, the United States, the leadership of the diplomatic corps and the national security apparatus, you know, really understood that going to war was potentially quite damaging to the legitimacy of the United States. Now, of course, the war in Vietnam was the real proof of that. in order to avoid those types of episodes of extreme violence, like the war in Vietnam, the United States wanted to prevent outbreaks of unrest, outbreaks of subversion, and using police was the way to do it. So the United States sends police to police trainers and advisors to 52 countries around the globe, and trains police from 77 countries around the globe in the United States. And in many cases, of course, police and military bureaucratically are blurred together in many countries around the globe. And then this process of using police to promote or institutionalize a regime of internal security required the practical merger of military and police missions, military and police technologies, personnel, ideas, repertoires, and so forth. And that's one of the things that I really demonstrate throughout the book, and also try to show the ways that within the United States, then some of the distinction between police and military that, you know, has a strong ideological power in the United States, some of the ways that it actually begins to fall apart in this period of 1945 to 1975. And of course, I would just, you know, sort of say that it might be possible to look at earlier periods, and of course, as well as the contemporary period, to look at different but related ways that those distinctions have fallen apart or blurred.
Right. So you did your PhD in American studies, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And your work spans counterinsurgency, policing, Cold War, military, civil rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's it like navigating an academy that has very distinct disciplinary silos when the very substance of your work is integrally overflowing those silos?
Well, I would have to say it's not the easiest thing to do. You know, one burden, of course, is that I feel like I have to try to become fluent in a number of literatures that certainly, if one remains within a disciplinary silo, it's not necessary to always read outside, although I think, of course, a lot of people do and a lot of people should, just to enrich their thinking. But for me, I think there, maybe I'm just a kind of strange, I have a strange personality. You know, it's like I'm interested in kind of deep archival research. I really like to do it. I get something out of it. I don't know, it's a sort of personality trait. I'm like a pack rat or something, and I'm a record collector in my spare time. So, you know, that interest in the kind of details and the minutia is something that I maintain in my work. I know that for people who are in IR and in various other kind of more theoretical fields, some of the archival detail may seem superfluous. At the same time, I think that the theoretical work that I'm also trying to do in the book, you know, I think that for a lot of disciplinary historians, the book would seem perhaps more theoretically inclined and explicit about some of the theoretical and methodological maneuvers I'm trying to make. I think that I'm trying to also make my work satisfying to people who are working more in that register. And for me as well, as much as I'm really interested in sometimes arcane archival minutia, I'm also really interested in theoretical debates and big conceptual questions about international relations, state power, the relationship of race and racism to state power and to the international system, questions about, as we've already discussed, the distinctions between police and military and the way they fall apart. So I'm really trying to do all of that at once, which is a difficult juggling act, and I did the best I could, and I hope it's satisfying to everybody, you know. And I would just say that, you know, to historians, like I said, I might seem more theoretically inclined, and then to theorists, I might seem overly empirical. And actually, you know, I think that some of the best work is exactly unsettling or dissatisfying because it doesn't necessarily do exactly what the disciplinary protocols might propose. It pushes against those boundaries and fits a bit uncomfortably. And certainly in American studies, where I got my PhD, this type of work is common. It doesn't always work out well. But you know, I think we're interested in American studies, at least in trying to kind of rethink some of the protocols, constantly trying to reinvent the field and reinvent our work and find new ways to approach these big questions.
Yeah. And I would actually say, I mean, there's a certain rendition of IR, which is very much a subfield of political science, right, which is fine. And then there's another rendition of IR, which is very much as a kind of interdisciplinary site, almost like an applied studies, but not quite. And I'm always struck by the similar nature of American studies and that kind of IR in terms of its capaciousness. Yeah. Right. So I think that's probably why your work actually does speak very comfortably to a particular kind of IR. Obviously, when you didn't write this and publish this only in 2020. Now, in hindsight, we're not at the end of 2020 yet, but we're into it a bit. At this point in time, what do you think, looking back, is the most important salient element of your book?
That's a really great question. I guess I would say two things. I mean, the first is that the book mounts a critique of the contemporary discourse of police militarization, which I think tends to be a bit ahistorical and also tends to kind of be founded on a notion that there is a very distinct institution called the police, and then there's another distinct institution called the military. Historically, they were separate. At some point, they become blurred together. So my work pushes back against that kind of narrative of a kind of, you know, fall from grace for police when it became militarized, to show that there actually has been a lot of blurriness for quite a long time. I started thinking about pushing back on the critique of police militarization in essence to make the critique, which I think is very useful and which many activists I think have made in powerful ways. I've been trying to make it stronger, not to push back against it to say that it's worthless, nothing like that. But I started that, you know, in some ways, even before the Ferguson moment, the first Black Lives Matter flash, but I finished, you know, my dissertation, which is the origin point for this book, really in 2014, 2015, at the exact height of protests, when that discussion about police militarization was quite prominent in the American media. So I was in dialogue with those events. And then, you know, I finished the book and it came out in late 2019. Nobody, I think, could have predicted what's happened in 2020, except to say we probably thought it was going to happen. We just didn't know when, right? And this leads to, I think, the other point that it feels increasingly important today, which is about the term counterinsurgency. And the book spends a fair amount of time trying to excavate the kind of practical meaning of this term, rather than just the sort of theoretical debates around it. But how was the term applied when it first emerged in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and how did the practical institutions that were developed by the U.S. national security state, how did they take it up and mobilize it, right? And I show in the book that policing was actually really central to counterinsurgency. And so once we understand the relationship of policing and counterinsurgency historically, I think it helps us to make some sense of what's going on today. particularly insofar as policing as counterinsurgency is meant to be preventive. And historically, when it fails to be preventive, what often happens is more intense violence on the part of the state. And I think the cycle of 2020, in many ways, has illustrated that kind of in real time in a relatively compressed period for observers in the United States, where policing actually failed to prevent these protests. Policing became the focal point of the protests, and police activity actually worsened and intensified the protests because police activity was so aggressive, violent, and over the top in many ways. And the protests actually grew in scope and scale because of police actions. All of that kind of script, I think, in many ways was written in earlier decades that I examine in my book. And I think that it highlights the ways, you know, our experience of what we've seen over the past few months highlights the ways that counterinsurgency oftentimes can lead to the very thing its practitioners are most afraid of, which is a more intensive and more cohesive insurgency. And I think that some people might be wary of applying the term insurgency to describe the current political mobilizations of Black Lives Matter. And I'm sympathetic to that because I don't want to imply that Black Lives Matter is not a peaceful protest. But I do think that we need to pay attention to the ways that the protest dynamics and tactics have been highly responsive to what the police and what the state has been doing. And we need to be, I think, wary of not paying close attention, or else we'll kind of miss some of these dynamics. We shouldn't just assume we know what is going to happen, even as we have there's some clear historical patterns that we can look at to make sense of it. So I think looking at history is useful, but that doesn't substitute for paying close attention to current events.
Oh, that's great. Stuart, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for your help with this symposium about the book. And I really hope that readers gain a lot from reading it. I certainly gained a lot from reading other brilliant scholars' responses to my work. So thank you.